Welcome to The Takeaway, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. Embassies around the world have been traditionally triumphs of architectural style and significance. They are both the symbol and workplace for two nations' engagement in world affairs. They are also symbols of tension and strife, and so down through history, certain embassies have seemed more like and have been built literally more like bunkers or fortresses. In the week since Ambassador Chris Stevens was killed at the American consulate in Benghazi, Libya, anti-American protests have spread rapidly from Lebanon to Indonesia, Pakistan, the latest attack in Afghanistan, a suicide bombing killing 13 people, mostly foreign workers. Given these protests targeting U.S. installations, it makes a world of difference to the work of this nation's courageous diplomatic corps, whether they are working in a bunker or a refuge or a space that facilitates a bilateral relationship or something like a stockade that signifies little or no relationship. We turn now to Barbara Bodine, former U.S. ambassador to Yemen. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Kurt Volker is also with us. He's a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Now, to both of you, have you ever had the experience of having worked in a facility that, while secure, is relatively open versus something that goes, because of diplomatic events, into being much more like a bunker, a kind of a green zone inside Baghdad, for instance? Barbara Bodine?
Yes, I've worked in both, and I've watched the evolution of our embassies over my career. I remember my very first post, we had absolutely no security. Anyone could walk into the embassy and walk upstairs. My last post was Yemen, and that was the first embassy site that we built post the bombing of our embassy in Beirut, to have the high walls, the stand back, and all of the security. So in the course of my career, I went from the open embassy to the bunker.
And Kurt Volker, the U.S., I mean, to be ambassador to NATO is to walk amongst the golden finery of old Europe. But I suspect you've had other experiences.
You haven't been to NATO.
Yeah. Believe me, that was not my career.
Yeah. Well, in any case, is the ambassador to NATO the same as being, say, hunkered down in a place like Cairo right now?
Well, let me describe NATO headquarters for you when I was there. So in the 1960s, the French decided to withdraw from the integrated military structure of NATO, and the headquarters was moved on a short notice from Paris to Brussels. The only space available that the Belgians made available was built and designed to be built as a military hospital on a military base. That was quickly converted to be the headquarters of NATO. And so it is very much like living and working in a 50-year-old hospital with lots of little wings, which is around a major security fence.
Well, that's unpleasant. How do these extraneous, sometimes random sort of facilities issues, including the high-tension security, and U.S. embassies all around the world went through another redesign post 9/11 and post the Tanzania embassy blasts in the Clinton administration. How have these various redesigns affected your work, Kurt?
I think that's the relevant question. As Barbara pointed out, the world's changed a lot from the time that she started her career, I started mine. The threats to U.S. diplomats abroad, the threats to ambassadors in particular, have increased and increased, and the capacities of people trying to kill them have increased as well. So we've had to react to that and try to find more secure ways for our diplomats to work. There's a tremendous tension between keeping our diplomats safe, which is vitally important not only for their own well-being but for the role and image of the United States, and at the same time trying to have our diplomats effectively engage with the population and the local authorities and the culture that is there. So you need to be out, but you also need to be secure. We started dealing with this in very ad hoc ways. I remember visiting Bosnia once, for example, where we were trying to reopen an embassy, and it was just sandbags around a building. And thanks to a lot of good architectural design, we've been able to make more workable embassies. But even as recently as 3 or 4 years ago, we were still grappling with the choice between, well, we need a new embassy. You can build a perfectly secure one with 10 acres and lots of setbacks and things, but you'll be 5 miles from the center of town. Or you can try to keep your embassy in the center of town and then try to figure out how you're going to work in as much security protections as possible, knowing it's never going to be perfect. I think a lot of diplomats, even though it's a risk to them personally, actually prefer to be in the heart of the cultural center of the country they're working in.
Barbara Bodine, where do you come down on this? Do you prefer to be in the Shuk, in the old city, or do you want the setbacks out by the beach?
Well, if we were out by the beach, it would be one thing. We tend to be in the most remote part of town, about as far from anything as you can get. I think one of the problems, and this was mentioned, is there is this idea that there is such thing as perfect security. If we build the embassy far enough away with high enough walls, there is such thing as perfect security, and there isn't. And so what the tension is what is reasonable risk management? You need to protect your people, but you need to be able to get out there. And I think almost every diplomat I've ever met, including the new ones coming in, want to be out there. They understand that diplomacy is engagement, and it's engagement well beyond just meeting with ministers in their government offices, that if you're not down in the souk, if you're not at the university, if you're not out in the governance meeting with people, then you simply cannot do your job. Well, and so,
Barbara, can you tell me a story about that? Is there some lower level diplomat, someone who is on track to be an ambassador maybe someday, who really does want to go out on the street, and you have to advise them about whether they're jeopardizing their own lives?
That was a constant issue when I was in Yemen, and actually in a number of other posts that I've been in. And it is an issue that is actually, in the Foreign Service, you actually become more of a target as you become more senior, that your junior officers have far more ability to move around. But, yes, it's a constant issue, and generally what you would do is that you would sit with your security people and try to come out with what is a good balance, what makes sense. The one concern that I've heard from junior officers and those considering the Foreign Service as a career is not the issue of the danger or the threat of going to places like Yemen or Bosnia or almost every place at this point. It's they do not wish to be confined to embassies. Mm. They understand that there is a certain risk inherent in doing the job. And so it's not so much a question of being able to get them outside the walls. It's really a question of trying to manage when and where and how they go so that they can do their job. They need to represent the United States. They need to understand the local culture and dynamic. You know, Chris Stevens was a superb example of this desire, this understanding of the professional need to be out and about.
And we're speaking with Barbara Bodine, who's an ambassador, former U.S. ambassador to Yemen. We're also talking with Kurt Volker, who's a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. Let's bring someone else in on our team here. Also in Washington is Andre Houston, who's an architect who designed the U.S. embassy in Cairo. We could speak about that embassy in Cairo, but just in general terms, how does an architect help these diplomats find spaces in which to do their jobs, both in security but not being isolated in a bunker or way out on the edge of town?
Well, for the Cairo embassy, the initial design was before the Inman report, before the attack on Beirut. And so there were less constraints on security constraints on how an embassy was built. There was a site downtown which was ideal. It was small. It was not a big sprawling site like the current embassies are on. Before the Inman report, you just made sure that you didn't have windows and entrances at the ground floor around the public areas, the sidewalks and the streets. The Inman report came out at the end of the design process, and the building was analyzed from the point of view of the Inman report. Fortunately, the design had been such that it was very secure, with one exception, the glass, the glazing could be if there was an explosion, the glazing would have been broken and turned into shards and killed everyone inside. And so that had to be redesigned. The glazing had to be redesigned because the building was so close to the street, and a blast would affect the glazing. I think there was a regulation that the building had to withstand the blast of 2,000 pounds of explosives at the point, at a public point nearest the embassy. And if you don't have an embassy set back from the road in a big campus, as we did not, one of the first things that's affected is the glass. And we had to design a new glazing, a new window system, essentially.
That's amazing. And you know, as has happened in history, architectural monuments from one time become something quite different in our time. Edward Durell Stone designed the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi, which is not a terribly loved building in India right now. And the Durell Stone building that was designed in Pakistan... Yeah, or the Foreign Service. And the Durell Stone building that was designed for Pakistan as payment for that, as kind of parody, it became the Nuclear Institute where A.Q. Khan developed all the nuclear bombs. So architects go into this business at their peril. Some final thoughts, Kurt Volker?
Well, I think that looking ahead, I think there's a question about how do we solve this problem of security and access for our diplomats around the world. And it really gets to rethinking the role of the Foreign Service in an internet globalized age. There are probably a lot of ways to think about how we do business, how people act, where they live, where they work, that we really need to take a fresh look at. The Foreign Service Act that we're working under was passed in 1980, before the internet, before the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I think it is time to start thinking about what we ask of our diplomats, what we expect them to do overseas, and the kind of foreign service we're building and the kind of service they give to our country.
What young diplomat that you can imagine who you've worked with or you can imagine who's out there in the Foreign Service right now, Barbara Bodine, are you most concerned about in this environment?
I think I would probably take a little bit of issue with my colleague that, you know, while we absolutely need to be able to work online and internet and everything else, there's never going to be a substitute for the personal contact. What Edward R. Murrow referred to, the last 3 feet. And so it is going to be an issue of sitting down and really working through what is risk management. My concern is that those young people that I work with who are looking into diplomacy are going to be put off by the fact that we've got them hermetically sealed and that we're not going to be able to attract the kinds of people that we need to serve this country abroad. So it's going to be a balance act.
It's a very remarkable conversation. Thanks so much to Barbara Bodine, former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, and Kurt Volker, former U.S. ambassador to NATO, and, of course, to Andre Houston, the architect who designed that very much embattled right now U.S. embassy in Cairo. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.